Hello and welcome to the How To Academy podcast, the bi-weekly show from London's home of big thinking. I'm Vas Christodoulou. Have you ever thought about the fact that every creature in the history of the world to gaze upon the night sky saw the exact same moon as you? Our guest on this episode, Rebecca Boyle, is a journalist who writes about the cosmos and astronomy, and she's just published Our Moon, a book exploring the satellite's profound influence on life on Earth. She sat down with Amy Morris to tell us more.
Rebecca, the first seeds of this book were planted many years ago when you listened to the Apollo 11 recordings in elementary school, and you've since become a lifelong moon enthusiast. What is it that has kept you so fascinated by the moon?
I don't know what it's been that I never lost, but I think a lot of young people really are fond of the moon. It's such a character in every bedtime story and so much children's literature, and I think I just kind of always held on to that fascination, and you know, it's been like a companion, I think, to me my whole life. And I wanted to write this book as a way of sharing my appreciation for it, I guess. I mean, I write about astronomy and astrophysics all the time, and the moon is often annoying if it comes up at all in these fields because it's like really bright. You have to schedule your observations when it's not up. If you're trying to study things like dark energy or, you know, quasars, distant galaxies, the moon is kind of an obstacle. And I always find myself kind of defending it and saying, no, the moon is really cool too, you know. And that's kind of how this book germinated. And then it really turned into more of an argument that, like, once I did the research, I was like, no, the moon is essential. The moon is really the most important thing about Earth in so many ways. And so I think it kind of evolved into more of that from my initial just sort of affinity for it.
I, for one, have never thought so much about the moon, but I will never take it for granted again, thanks to your book.
I'm glad.
Your grandfather, Jack, witnessed firsthand the power that the moon can have on historical human events. How did the moon shape his experience of the Second World War?
So my grandfather was a Marine in the U.S. when he was 17. He enlisted because he, you know, like so many other young Americans, wanted to be part of this war and wanted to be part of the fight. He was sent to the South Pacific, and he was in what became known as the Battle of Tarawa, which is the worst battle in the history of the U.S. Marine Corps. But so the story is that the Allies were trying to capture this Coral Atoll in the South Pacific because it had an airstrip. And this was an important place to go to get closer to eventually Japan and potentially an invasion of Japan. So they really wanted this strategic airstrip on this little island. And they knew that if they wanted to take the island from Japanese forces, they'd have to have a high tide because it was surrounded by a coral reef. And they had to get their flat-bottomed boats over the reef to get closer to shore. So they tried to plan the invasion for a rising tide. And the problem was they didn't have tide charts, really, for most of the world. The only tide chart data that anyone had was from the age of maritime exploration in the 1800s, or, you know, the coast of Chile, like 2,000 miles away. And so there wasn't really any good data about what the tide was going to do on this island when it came in. And they didn't know, and I don't think anyone really pieced this together until the last decade, that the moon was at last quarter, so it was half full in the middle of the night and kind of up in the sky in the morning, but it was farther away in its orbit. So it's the opposite of a supermoon, which we have actually just recently. This was a supermoon. The new moon that just happened in March of this year was a supermoon. We have a lot of supermoons coming up in the early part of 2024. But this was the opposite of that, where it was a micro moon. It's more distant in its orbit around the Earth. And so its gravitational pull is weaker. So the tide is weaker. And the high tide is lower than usual. And a low tide is weaker than usual. So the tide never rose. They ended up calling it the dodging tide because the tide waters never came up over the reef. So the Marines got stuck. All these boats beached on the coral reef surrounding Tarawa, and they had to get out and wade across, you know, 5 feet of water holding their rifles overhead. And, you know, it was catastrophic because now the Japanese forces were just shooting And something like 3,000 Marines died in this battle in 2 days of fighting. And my grandfather was part of the battle, but he wasn't part of the land invasion. He was equipping airplanes with bombs. So he was on another island a few hundred miles away. And he arrived a few days later after the Allies eventually do take the island and you know, take it over. But not until, you know, many, many people died. And people back home in the U.S. were really upset by this battle. It was, how could this tiny island like be worth this, you know? And how do we not know that the tide wouldn't come in? What's wrong with us that we didn't know this? And so this is one of the things that sparks the formation of the NOAA Office of Oceanography in the United States to measure the oceans and to study how the moon affects them. And it wasn't until much more recently that an astronomer pieced this together, the story of where the moon was in the sky precisely at the time of this battle and the phase of the moon and its distance from Earth all played a role in this tide not coming in. To me, it was just so compelling because I knew this story from my own childhood of my own family, but I never knew this connection that it had to the moon. And it really spoke to me as an example of the many, many ways that we don't fully understand or appreciate the role the moon plays in our lives, even from, you know, the most important battles of the most famous recent wars in our modern history.
Absolutely. Well, let's go further back in history. You've taken some really interesting field trips for the purpose of your research. What did you discover in Aberdeenshire?
Oh yeah, this is probably my favorite chapter. I went to northeastern Scotland where there are these series of stone circles and a very specific type of monument that are all really consequential for the way that humans use the moon in the Stone Age. I mean, this is dating to 10,000 years ago, is the oldest one. So there's this Craith's Castle. I'm not going to pronounce it correctly, but in Aberdeenshire, there's this sort of 14th century castle, and it's this sort of famous, you know, National Trust site. But a few years ago, some archaeologists working in the area found evidence of these alignment of pits. And this came up after actually an aerial survey during a period of drought a few years ago. People were flying over a lot of these sort of areas and you would notice barrows or Neolithic ruins under the soil that would be more visible when the soil is sort of slumped and very dry during these periods of drought. And so a team of archaeologists excavated this field near this castle and found an old timber hall that had been burned by fire sometime in the late Stone Age, and evidence of this series of 13 pits in the ground that were dug into the earth and redug and then refilled and then redug again for a very long time. And they weren't quite sure what to make of them, but they felt like it had something to do with the passage of time. And then later, another landscape architect, archaeologist, looked at them again, and to him, it represented the faces of the moon. And if this is true, which I think it probably is, this represents what we have found to be the oldest landscape monument that connects the moon to the earth and to time. And it might be one of the earliest ways people used the moon to sort of orient ourselves in time, to mark time, not just time gone by, but time to come, which is a really important development and an extremely consequential leap in thinking for early humans. I mean, as far as we know, we're the only species that does this, that mentally time travels. It's possible that, you know, whales maybe do this or elephants or other social, very intelligent species, but we can't ask them. So as far as we know, humans are the only animals that say, oh, in the sixth moon of the year, I'm going to go on vacation or, you know, I'm going to take a trip. And this Warren Field is the name of this site at this castle in Aberdeenshire, might be the first evidence we have of people doing this, of planning future time and using time to orient themselves to not only the year, but to one another, to other cultures, to the seasons and the harvest and the hunt. All these things that humans needed to be able to survive and to create the earliest forms of civilization.
The word calendar derives from lunar timekeeping, mm-hmm. as does the word month. And we're recording this conversation on the Ides of March, made famous by Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. How was the moon central to the real Caesar's life in Roman times?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite characters in all of world history. And I've kind of had like a lifelong obsession with Julius Caesar as well. So it was nice to be able to connect these two things for me. He is kind of the bad guy, the first sort of bad guy in the story of the moon. He's the first person to separate the moon from time, because when he takes over as dictator at Rome, he realizes that the lunar year and the solar year are out of alignment. And I mean, this is the case, you know, every calendar across Earth, because there are 354 days in 12 lunar cycles. And 365.25, which is why we had leap year this year, days in a solar year. That's a 12-day difference. And so over just a couple of years, if you only use the moon to mark your months, you're a month off from the sun. So over a few years, you know, your harvest festival is going to fall in the middle of spring. And, you know, you have to figure out how to reset the calendar. And people across cultures across this planet found different ways to do that. And they were sometimes very complicated, these intercalary schemes. People would just add a random month here and there, or add some days. The 12 days of Christmas actually is a holdover from this same tradition. And in the time of Caesar, when he takes over, it's so far out of whack. And Rome is so large at this point. The empire is so far flung that different provinces are not getting the memo, essentially, when it comes time to fix the calendar and to add this intercalary month. And so he just is like, you know what, this is not working. And so he does away with the calendar entirely. He works with a mathematician who was in the court of Cleopatra and probably met this person while he was there in Alexandria, and figures out that really what we should use is the sun. And we just have to make up months that used to be, you know, affiliated with the moon, but now are just sort of imaginary timescales. And the Ides of March used to be the 15th day of the month. It was when the moon was full. The Calends was when the moon was new. So the first sighting of the new moon is the beginning of the new month. And that day was called the Calends. And that's the word that gives us the word calendar. But Caesar is like, this is too complicated. We're just going to make it all up and say, there are 12 random months. We're going to give them random names. And we're just going to have nothing to do with the moon anymore. So January is named for Janus, the Roman god of, well, he sort of represents duality. He looks forward and backward. So it's sort of a nice god to have represent the beginning of a new year after the solstice, the winter solstice. You know, the rest of the months of the year just have different names, depending on, sometimes they're named for a god. March is named for the god of war, Mars. But July is now named for Julius Caesar. August is named for his nephew, Augustus. But it used to be just Sextus and Quintilius, because those are the names for the fifth and sixth months. September is still the seventh month of the year. It's actually the ninth now because of how we divide it, but that's what the name comes from. October is the eighth, November is the ninth, and December is the 10th. And so that was just what they called them. And it's the first time the moon is no longer the way that we mark time and that we use a calendar that connects us to the moon. So it sort of falls from power at this point in the story and in the book, because Julius Caesar is like, that's just not worth this complication.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Marquee TV. Marquee TV is an incredible streaming service that is a gateway to arts and culture. With my subscription, I've enjoyed watching some of the Royal Shakespeare Company's most acclaimed productions of recent years, including David Tennant in Richard II and Simon Russell Beale in The Tempest. I've seen multiple productions of The Ring Cycle and Thelonious Monk playing in Brussels in 1963. I've watched Alice in Wonderland at the Royal Opera House and Giselle at La Scala. Marquee TV really is the most accessible way into culture I've ever encountered, and a treasure trove for any arts lover. You can try it for 3 months for just 99p. Yep, 3 months for 99p with the code HOWTO. Just visit marquee.tv and use the promo code HOWTO to dive into the world of the arts like never before.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've taken a trip to see the moon itself, or at least bits of the moon brought back by the Apollo missions. What was your experience like at the Lunar Sample Lab in Houston?
This was such an interesting day in several ways. I really wanted to see the lunar samples just because I wanted to be able to describe where they're kept and what they look like. And it felt like an important sort of ending to the story of, you know, the pieces of the moon are kind of brought back home. But I didn't expect it to be this almost like spiritual experience. And I think it's in part because I was so interested in them and so excited to see them at this point that it really was meaningful to me, but also because of the way that they're treated and the way that they're maintained and studied and observed. There's this sort of reverence for them that's really hard to deny. And, you know, only certain people are allowed to touch them. There's these really elaborate processes you have to undergo to get into the lab itself, into this clean room. You have to put yourself all in white in this bunny suit, head to toe. You know, it's like a purification ritual. And I mean, it literally is to purify you, to make sure that you're not bringing in any contamination that would affect the way the scientists can study these samples, because they're very pristine. They're kept in inert gas in these cabinets. They're locked away in a vault that has a bank, like a Federal Reserve vault door on it when they're not in use. But even when they're being studied or when they're in use in the lab and the lab preps are, you know, preparing them to send to scientists, there is a very extreme level of precaution to keep them pristine for study. And that lends this sort of almost spirituality to the whole experience. And I found that very interesting and very almost moving, because it was like relics, you know. It's like looking in, if you've ever been in Notre Dame or some of the other great cathedrals of the world, you know, where there are relics of saints and popes, and in the Vatican, the sort of air of solemnity combined with profundity and the awesome in the old sense of the word, where it's just this awe-inspiring and you're almost kind of weak-kneed because it's overpowering. And that's how it felt. It was like, this is the moon. It is something from someplace else. And it is really sort of surreal to me still that this happened, that we went there and brought it back. Like, it's bizarre and transformative. And so seeing them and being with these rocks really was like a profound experience. And I was trying to convey that in the book.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it was almost holy. But I also find it mind-boggling that there are sometimes pieces of the moon in the mail, and the sample lab can't add sort of special delivery labels or insurance, because it is literally invaluable.
Yeah, they told me, I mean, what's the point of putting insurance on it? Like, what are we going to do? Like, get a couple $100? Like, okay, you know, I mean, it's literally irreplaceable and priceless. And so they just kind of hope for the best. And there is a very detailed process to request samples. Like, scientists can put them in only a couple times a year. There's an application process. You have to be very specific about what you want to do with the samples and how you need them prepared, you know, which one you want. Because each Apollo mission brought back different types of rocks and different places on the moon that they visited. And so scientists usually have very specific things they want to see in these samples and what they want to do with them. And so that's all part of this process of applying to receive a lunar sample.
And how have the moon rocks informed our understanding of how the moon was made and its link to Earth?
Yeah, this is a really interesting kind of ongoing story, actually. This is one of the most interesting debates in planetary science, I think, that we don't really know how the moon got here, which I think it's the moon. Like, shouldn't we know? Shouldn't we have a pretty good idea of, like, what happened here? And we really are not sure. We think probably that there was some giant impact early in Earth's history. So this is the most widely accepted theory now since Apollo, something really horrible had to have happened for the moon to look the way it does. And partly because it's low density, it has this kind of crumbly, flaky outer crust. And for that to happen, the material that makes the crust had to have floated there. And for it to float to the top, you know, like a ice in a glass of water, like the whole moon would have to have been molten for that to happen. And that would have required very, very violent conditions. And so this is kind of one of the genesis of this great impact theory, giant impact hypothesis, that something the size of Mars probably smashed into early Earth early in its history, and both planets were totally destroyed. And there's nothing left from this. There's no like craters. It's both planets are totally vaporized and both reform anew, the moon and the Earth as we know it now. But the particulars of how this happened, and did they both totally vaporize, or is the moon just like a leftover chunk of the impactor? Like, all these are still active questions. And the Apollo rocks threw us into some debate over this in the last 15 to 20 years, because again, once they brought back the samples, they decided to wait on a few of them. There was a lot of immediate study on them over the next course of the 70s and the 80s. And then in 2001, there was a new group of scientists who wanted to use much more advanced instruments and methods to study these samples. So they re-measured a lot of moon rocks. When they first were measured, they looked different enough from Earth that people figured, well, the whole moon had to have melted. This was really violent. Probably it happened in this giant impact. And the moon is the leftover piece of that impactor because it looks different enough from Earth rocks that they can't be the same thing. In 2001, an updated study looked at a whole bunch of other moon rocks and certain chemicals in all of them and said, actually, this looks a lot like Earth. Like, actually, it's almost identical to Earth. All these, the ratios of certain chemicals in the rocks are the same as the ratios of Earth rocks, which is really strange because of how we think planets form. They form in different places around the sun. This doesn't make much sense for the moon and the Earth to have formed from the same stuff at the same time. And so that's what kind of led to this whole new flowering of research on the giant impact hypothesis and how it could have worked. And we're still not totally sure. But one of the more recent theories is that there was this totally unknown planetary structure that arose from this event that's like this fluffy cloud of vapor, basically. It's so catastrophic that both planets completely melt, essentially, and are just droplets. And in this cloud, they both recoalesce into the moon and the Earth, and that's how they can look identical. But we don't know exactly, and we don't know how that worked, and if it ever happened anywhere else, that would be weird. Like, there's a lot of other questions about this process that are still unknown.
But incredible that we're still uncovering some of this in very recent research, as you say, 2021. This really is ongoing and goes back to the beginning of time. And until Apollo, nobody knew which elements composed the moon and what effect those might have on the human body. What were some of the fears around the moon's chemistry, and what precautions did NASA take ahead of and during the moon landing of 1969?
Yeah, there was a lot of fear and uncertainty. And it's in some ways funny now and quaint to think about how they were afraid of things like lunar quicksand or, you know, lunar pathogens, you know, but there was a lot of concern. We had no idea. We had no way of knowing what the moon would hold in store. We had some good images from spacecraft that were orbiting it. We had a couple of landers up there taking, you know, instruments and taking some readings, but we really had no way of knowing what the moon was like. And so the astronauts had very detailed instructions about how to protect themselves in case the lunar dust ignited in the space capsule. They were quarantined when they got back. They were, after being in this tiny capsule, you know, all three of them for several days there and back, they get home, land on Earth, and have to go back into another very tightly sealed small capsule for several days because people were worried that they were infected with some kind of moon germs, and they would have brought home some sort of lunar pandemic.
Or indeed being radioactive, and, perhaps.
Or be radioactive, but we just had no idea. And, you know, of course, they were totally fine, and the moon has nothing on it that we need to worry about, except maybe the dust, but it's not going to really do anything bad to Earth or to life on Earth. But they also did the same thing for all the samples. They put them in containers with a whole bunch of animals and plants and, you know, to see what would happen if these were exposed to moon material or lunar radiation or whatever the moon might have had. They were also really worried about landing on the moon and having the moon be so soft that it would swallow up the landers like a quicksand. You know, imagine just sort of, you don't stop sinking in because it's this powder. And they kind of planned for this. There were a few people who were really worried about this and kept kind of sounding the alarm. They're like, they're just going to sink in and what are we going to do? You know? And there were some that were like, well, it's probably pretty soft, but it's not going to like sink in forever. But they all expected it to be very soft. And it is fairly soft walking on the moon. The regolith is very powdery. It's kind of like walking through baking flour. But Neil Armstrong set down the Eagle lander so gently that it didn't sink in as much as they thought it would. So it was actually really hard to get down onto the surface because he was supposed to land and like the legs were supposed to kind of settle in a little bit, like by several inches, kind of like sink into the sand, the regolith. But they didn't. And so he had to kind of jump like 3 feet to get down. And that was a little bit scary because it was like, well, now we have to climb back up with all these rocks and all of our bulky spacesuits. And so that was one of the other surprising precautions, I guess.
And when it comes to contemporary space exploration, you talk quite movingly about the need to respect the legacy of the moon and really interrogate why we want to go back. Should we go back?
I think so. I do. I think people should be up there. I think we just need to be a lot more thoughtful about why and, you know, for whom we're going and for what purpose we're going. I don't think that's been well interrogated, especially in the last couple of years, as there's this sort of headlong rush up there among all the spacefaring countries. You know, Japan just landed a new lander on the moon a few weeks ago, becoming the fifth country to land something up there safely. China is going up there again, probably this year. India has more designs on new rovers. They landed last fall another rover. Russia, the former Soviet Union, had several things on the moon, but now Russia has some lunar programs. NASA has its Artemis program. And now through Artemis, all these commercial landers are being built in the U.S. that are privately funded or privately owned. And we just had two attempts. One of them didn't make it because of a fuel issue. One of them did make it and landed on the moon a couple weeks ago. And it kind of tipped over because the guidance system had some issues and it was tilted in such a way that it couldn't get enough sunlight on its solar panels. But it still was a huge success in terms of a private company, privately funded and, you know, raising money and then publicly traded later, it was able to land this thing up there. It's not a NASA spacecraft. NASA has funded part of it, but it's not owned by a government agency. And that's a first. So there's a lot of activity and a lot of interest on the moon. And I think less thought about why this is happening and why it's important right now and why we should be there. I think we should go for science and exploration. And I think there's sort of an intangible value of sending people to the moon just for inspiration and for excitement and for, you know, to show that it's something we can do. It's sort of the Edmund Hillary quote about climbing, you know, Everest is because it's there. And I think that's valuable in terms of pure research and exploration. But I hope that as that is done, there is more thought about what the moon represents and what we're doing this for and why and, you know, to whom it matters. I mean, these two private landers going up there, both are carrying all this kind of random payloads, because if it's a private company, like anybody who wants to pay them to carry something up there can do that. The first one was carrying several small capsules that contained a small amount of human cremated remains. And the loved ones of these people who died were able to pay this company to send their loved ones' ashes to the moon. And it was called a memorial space flight. They took it very seriously. It was very solemn. But the Navajo Diné people in the American Southwest were really offended by this because in their cosmology, the moon is sacred. And sending up, you know, human remains or turning into a burial site or, you know, a disposal site even is really offensive to them. And they contacted, the Navajo president contacted NASA. and several other officials in the U.S. government saying, this is outrageous. You can't do this. You know, please consult with us if you're going to do something like this. And NASA's answer this time was like, well, it's not our spaceship. You know, we're just a customer. We're just sort of like, it's a ride share for us, you know. And to me, it just really illustrated that the moon represents many things to many people, as it has through all of human history. And just because there are some people right now who can access it physically doesn't give those people the right or the power to do whatever they want. I think there should be some thought about what the moon means to everyone and what it's done for this planet, you know. And I hope one of the upshots of the book is like, what do we owe the moon now after all of this history, these unrecognized things that have happened on this planet because of the moon's influence? I hope that it means more to us than just a place to either go mining or, you know, to create some sort of lunar economy and just explore. I hope it's a little bit more profound than that.
And if you had the opportunity, would you go to the moon, or do you prefer observing from down here?
I think I'm okay observing from down here. I mean, when I was younger, I think I was more inclined to say, yes, I would go. And I mean, you know, I've evolved a little bit in that thinking, in part because now I have small kids, but also because it seems more possible. It's kind of funny how, like, you know, people ask you, like, would you go to space or go to the moon? Like, oh, yeah, sign me up, you know. And then it's like, well, here's a ticket. I'd be like, oh, well, actually, not sure. I do want to do that. Like, that's, if it becomes more plausible, it becomes more frightening to me. And I think that's sort of the state we're in, where it doesn't seem crazy that's a possibility. And so I feel a little bit more hesitant about it now.
It's no longer science fiction.
Right. Yeah.
If there's one idea about our moon that you want readers to take from the book, what would that be?
I think the just primary idea that I don't think we would be here without it. And I mean that in terms of the literal evolution of life on Earth and the movement of life out of the oceans onto land to just human culture and modern society. I think we owe so much to the moon and the development of all of these things, and it hasn't fully been appreciated in the past. I really think it's probably one of the most important things about this planet, and plays a role in all the other important things about this planet, from the tide to potentially things like plate tectonics, to their atmosphere and the life on this planet and how that affects the atmosphere, to the stability of Earth's climate. All of these characteristics that make Earth Earth and make it habitable for us, I think, are owed at least in part, if not entirely, to the presence of the moon. And I hope people think about that too as we look for other planets that might be hospitable for life. We should be thinking about planets that have moons.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me.
This episode starred Rebecca Boyle and was presented by Amy Morris. I produced the show with Nicole Wong, and our editor is John Doughty. Until next time, I'm Vas Christodoulou. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.